hello, and thank you for joining us for the latest installment of A Journey Through Stock Aitken Waterman. By now, you should know that I'm Gavin Scott from chartbeats.com.au, and you should be well aware that this is Matthew Denby.
Hello, everyone right around the world. It's good to be here talking about some of our favourite music from the wonderful year of 1988. So far, we've had an amazing run of hits from Saw for that year, but this week, as well as a couple more big hits, we're also going to hear a few songs that didn't fly at all.
Yes, we have two hits and two flops this episode, and Matt, I think we can agree that one of the flops probably deserved it, but the other did not.
Yes, definitely, Gavin. One's an underappreciated classic and the other is just straight up awful.
Yes, I would agree with that assessment, but we're not going to agree on everything this episode, are we, Matt?
Well, I hope not, Gavin. I hope not.
Okay, let's get ready to rumble then as we talk about the week's first song, Mind Over Matter by E.G. Daily. That was Mind Over Matter by E.G. Daily. And before Matt and I have at it, let's get the non-controversial stuff out of the way. Mind Over Matter was taken from the soundtrack to American comedy Summer School. Matt, have you ever seen that film?
No, I have not, Gavin, but looking at the trailer on YouTube, I don't think I missed very much at all. This movie starred Mark Harmon and Kirstie Alley, as well as future Melrose Place star Courtney Thorne Smith. So if you have a thing for 80s stars or teen movies of that era, you might want to check it out. Just don't expect too many belly laughs, though, judging by the trailer, Gavin.
Right, I thought you might have done your due diligence like you did with Knights and Emeralds, but not in this case. Now, like the movie, the song was actually released in the US in 1987, but it finally came out in the UK in May 1988. I'm not sure if the movie was even released in the UK. It's not listed on IMDb, but no doubt the UK label, A&M, didn't want a Saw-produced single going to waste, and so out it came. But Matt, it didn't chart very well, did it?
Well, not on the mainstream pop charts, Gavin, but it did quite well on the US dance charts. It got to a lowly 96 in the UK, but hit number 7 on the US Billboard Hot Dance Club Sounds charts and 22 on the Cashbox 12-inch dance singles chart. In New Zealand, it did do a bit better, cracking the top 40 there. It got to number 37 in the Land of the Long White Cloud. Now, E.G. Daily didn't have a huge profile in most international markets at this time, so I wonder, hint, hint, foreshadow, foreshadow, if this track would have done a lot better if it was fronted by a bigger name.
Well, that is a very good question. E.G. Daily wasn't very well known in the UK, you're right. The E.G. stands for Elizabeth Gutman. Incidentally, Daily is a stage name. She did, however, have a profile in America, where she's from, but it was more for her acting than her singing. She'd appeared in films like Valley Girl and Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
She'd also released a couple of singles prior to Mind Over Matter that had been dance hits in the US, but major chart success had eluded her. Let's take a listen to some of those.
That was E.G. Daily's excellent first two singles, Say It, Say It, which she co-wrote with Stephen Bray and Tony C, and which Jellybean produced, and Love in the Shadows, which she co-wrote with Harold Faltermeyer, who also produced it. And Love in the Shadows was actually included on the UK and Australian single of Mind Over Matter as a double A-side. Matt, E.G. was moving in some pretty A-list circles in terms of songwriters and producers, wasn't she?
She was, but still not at the level achieved by the other person who's become associated with this track. Now, this person I'm referring to isn't just a household name. They're a genuine legend of pop music, and I can't help but wonder what might have happened had they released this track instead of E.G.
Well, this is where things get interesting. Before E.G. laid down her vocal for Mind Over Matter with Saw, it was actually recorded by none other than Debbie Harry. Let's hear her version, which leaked online a few years ago.
Oh,
Wow, that is just stunningly good, Gavin. I prefer it over EG's version. To me, there's absolutely no competition whatsoever. Every line is just dripping with Debbie Harry charisma, and she shows that vocally, less can often be more. She doesn't do some of the throaty vocal gymnastics EG does, but she still easily wins the day with sheer charisma. I feel this would have been a top 10 hit for Debbie had she released it at the right time. Now, the production, which is exactly the same as the EG version, harks back to maybe 18 months prior to its UK release. It's got that Dead or Alive high energy flavour all through it. But even though the sound isn't super contemporary for 1988, the song itself is just fantastic, and Debbie is perfect on it. In another place and time, this could have been a supercharger for her solo career. It would have been a massive hit, and maybe even led to a full album with Saw. We can dream, can't we, Gavin?
We can, but I disagree with you. I actually prefer EG's version. I feel like there's more life to her vocal, whereas I find Debbie's a bit cold and clinical. And I know that's very Debbie Harry at times. She doesn't do, as you said, all those big throaty wows and things like that that we get from the EG version. And, you know, having said all that, I really like the Debbie version. It's just that the EG version gives it a bit more of a lift. I think it's a really good song. And yes, it would be really hard to do a bad job of this track, especially with Saw on production duties. But yeah, I would give EG's the edge. So why didn't Debbie's version of Mind Over Matter get released? For that answer, let's go to one of the song's writers, Michael J. And it turns out Debbie wasn't even the first one to record it. Here's Michael to explain the backstory.
Well, how far back should we go? Because there was a version released long before the Summer School soundtrack. It was not a hit. It came out in London. Same A&R guy as Five Star, by the way, Peter Robinson. He signed a girl named Nikki Leaguer, and they released a single, and they did Mind Over Matter. And Christopher Neal, who was the producer for Sheena Easton and Micah and the Mechanics, he produced the record, and he did a great job of it. A hit. I don't think it ever even charted. It's so obscure. For that reason, when the song was submitted for the film, it couldn't be eligible for like an Oscar because it wasn't written for the film. There had been another version released prior to that. But the film was just, they just needed a scene where everybody, the students, the delinquent students were taking their test. And I thought, I had the song, Mind Over Matter, We're Doing What Can't Be Done. And it lyrically, it felt like it worked. So we submitted it to the film people and they loved it. And then they just took it and tried to find a way to use it on the soundtrack. And it was Chrysalis Records who was doing the soundtrack. And they somehow connected it with Stockake and Waterman. I had nothing to do with it. And Stockake and Waterman did it with Debbie Harry. And they sent me a cassette to listen to. And I freaked out because I was a huge Blondie fan. Like, Debbie Harry can do no wrong. And now she's singing a song that I wrote. It was like the highlight of my life. I absolutely loved it. It sounded like, you know, one of the classic Blondie hits like Heart of Glass or Call Me. It sounded like it was going to be massive. So you can understand that I was completely devastated when they told me that they were going to have to remove her vocals. Like, they couldn't have it with her singing it because there was a label dispute. She had just left Chrysalis Records to sign, I think it was with Geffen or another label, and they didn't want to give them singles rights to her old label. It was just something as stupid as that, really. They wouldn't give singles rights to her old label. They would let her have it on the album, but they wouldn't let it be a single. And the movie said, this is our theme song. It has to be a single. If we can't release it as a single with Debbie Harry, we have to find another artist. And that's kind of what happened. But E.G. Daly came to the rescue, and she's a wonderful singer. She had done movie soundtracks before. She did a couple songs of the Scarface soundtrack and the Breakfast Club soundtrack. I mean, she was like the soundtrack queen at that time. And she's a great singer, and she's a good friend of mine. So she came in and she sang it. Debbie Harry's background vocals can still be heard in the record. I'm sure you picked that out. There's some samples of her in there in harmonies and stuff. So she's still in there. But yeah, EG released it, and you know, it was a top 10 hit for her, and she's still performing it today. So
how did EG get involved other than her experience doing soundtrack stuff? Was she on Chrysalis?
She was signed to A&M Records. I've been in this business for a long time. I've seen a lot of strange things, but nothing as strange as this. I mean, if you collect records, you've probably never seen anything like this. The 7-inch 45 of Mind Over Matter by E.G. Daly is on the Chrysalis label, the Blue Chrysalis label. But the 12-inch is on A&M. I don't understand how that happens. They must have figured that out in the contracts, because she was an artist who was signed to A&M. So that was just a weird thing.
So you would think, after all the trouble they had with Debbie Harry and label disputes, why would they overcomplicate it by choosing another artist not on their label, other than that she's great?
I know. Isn't that strange? I have no idea. But thank God for the internet, because as much as I love E.G. Daily, I don't want to say anything bad about her because we're good friends. I love her. She's a great singer and you should listen to her albums. But I always wanted people to hear the Debbie Harry version, and someone leaked it and it's all over the internet. I mean, it's easy to find and I'm so glad it's out there. I don't make any money from it because it's all illegal leaks and stuff, but I'm just glad it's out there, you know?
It's good to hear. I actually prefer E.G.'s version, I have to say.
Oh, that's great. That's cool.
But I don't know. I think there's something about E.G.'s performance that feels got a bit more energy to it.
That's interesting. I mean, E.G. is a very energetic performer. All of her songs, she's got that huge amount of energy. Great, great vocalist. She's also a very famous voiceover artist currently. Yes. She's Tommy Pickles, the voice of Tommy Pickles, and the voice of Babe in the Pig movies. She's fantastic.
I guess it's safe to say you were a fan of Saw's production on both versions of the song.
Absolutely. Well, it was the same track. They just replaced the vocalist, really. And the track just killed me. I loved it. I loved it. I mean, they could have put Pete Burns on that track.
Have you crossed paths with Stockacre Waterman at all?
Everybody asks me that all the time. And I don't want to disappoint you, but here's the truth. I have never met or spoken with any of them. It's just so crazy. I'm like one of their biggest fans. I mean, I've spent a lot of time doing writing work in England. If they had called me and wanted me to come in for a session, I would have loved it. But no, I've never met them or spoken to them. And it's just weird because I'm somehow always connected to them through Mind Over Matter. And through Cross My Heart, of course, because that was done at PWL. But also, you know, I was the first producer after Stockacre Waterman to work with Kylie Minogue and on the Rhythm of Love album. So, you know, I actually have that credit on a PWL label with my name on it. And yet I've still never met or spoken to them. I don't know why.
So that's that answered. Now, Matt, as we heard, that's not the only link Michael J has with Stockacre Waterman.
Yes, that's right. We'll be hearing about his work on Rhythm of Love in due course. I'm really excited to get to that one. As I foreshadowed way back in episode one, to me, that is one of Saw's most glorious moments, and I can't wait to get to it.
And as Michael mentioned, he wrote Cross My Heart, which, like Mind Over Matter, also did the rounds, being recorded by a number of different artists. One of those acts was Eighth Wonder, who took it to number 13 in the UK around this time in mid-1988. That version was produced by PWL's Pete Hammond, but it was also recorded by Tracy Spencer and Martika, whose version Michael produced. Let's hear those three versions of Cross My Heart. Okay, 10 points if you could identify that was Tracy Spencer, Eighth Wonder and Martika in that order with Cross My Heart. Matt, do you have a favourite?
I absolutely do, Gavin. Love the Eighth Wonder version. Love that wonderful PWL production on it from Pete Hammond. He did a great job. I was a bit of a Patsy Kensett fan at the time, and it's a standout track from the Eighth Wonder album. But all three acts do a great job with it. This is a really strong pop song that takes me right back to 1988. Michael J always felt strangely adjacent to Saw for me, especially Martika's poppier stuff. Don't you reckon, Gavin?
Yeah, there are very strong links between Michael and PWL, and given that PWL link, let's hear Michael talk about this track. Let's talk about Tracy Spencer's version. Was that the first version, or is there another obscure version hidden away somewhere?
Well, no, those were the three versions that sort of came out of this within the same time period. Tracy Spencer, Martika, and Eighth Wonder. That was an interesting time for me. And I don't know the chronology, to be honest, but you might know better than I do, because I'd have to look it up maybe on Wikipedia. I don't know. All I know is that I was laser focused on Martika's project. I kind of discovered her and I wanted to develop her as an artist. And I shopped her record deal and I ended up writing and producing her whole first album. And Cross My Heart was a big part of that. While I was shopping the record deal, her demo of that song was in the package that we were using to try and get a label interested. And we had a lot of labels that wanted her. We were in a bidding war with her. And when you get in a bidding war, though, it creates this long delay. There's just, you know, it takes so much time for these people to make decisions and for money to change hands and contracts and all that. And my publisher at the time, I was in the red. They were paying me and I hadn't had any big hits yet. So all they cared about was getting some of their money back. And in my contract with them, I wasn't allowed to exclusively hold any of my songs. If I wrote a song and they owned it, they would shop it and try and find a placement for it. That's all they cared about. I honestly don't know if they believed that it would end up being a part of Martika's album. So Martika and I had so many songs. We had like 30 songs by the time we made that album. So I think they thought, oh, they won't miss this one. And they were the ones who shopped it. They sent it to Capitol Records for Tracy Spencer. I forget how it got to Eighth Wonder, but over here, it was one of Tommy Mottola's first releases when he first became the president of CBS.
So it was almost like, it was like Oprah, you get Cross My Heart and you get Cross My Heart and you get Cross My Heart.
That's a great way to look at it, yeah. And it's funny because I mean, Tracy's version was just on the album, and then the Eighth Wonder version came out and it actually charted. And so then we had to have the conversation with Martika, like, this song is now on the chart. Do you still want it on your album? Because people think you're doing it as a cover version, even though I wrote it for her. She was, no, yeah, I love it. I still want it on my album. The weird thing is, Martika's album was on the same label as Eighth Wonder. So so they both ended up with Sony Music, and the executives there didn't seem to care. They were more focused on other singles from Martika, like Toy Soldiers and stuff. So they didn't care. They let us put it on the album. So we got all three versions released.
What did you think of Tracy's version and Eighth Wonder's version?
They're very different, of course. I mean, Tracy took it in a super R&B direction, which I kind of liked. It had no relation to my demo at all. But I love when people reinterpret stuff. It's great. I love getting cover versions of songs. So I liked her version as it was as an R&B record. But I got to tell you, Patsy Kensit, that video, oh my God, she was just, I had such a crush on her. What can I say? She was fantastic. And I love being a part of that album because the Pet Shop Boys were also on it. And there were some, you know, there were just some great writers who were part of that. So I love being a part of that project. I was over the moon about that version. That was great.
Now, Martika's version, obviously you got to produce that yourself.
Right.
Was it nice to put, after these other versions had come out or at the same time as these other versions were coming out, was it nice to put your own producer's touch on it?
Yeah, I didn't really think about that at the time because, like I said, it took me a couple of years to develop Martika, and we did like 30 songs. We were always in the studio writing and producing songs. So when it came time to actually make the album, I was pretty much just imitating what we did on the demos. The demos were our blueprints production-wise. Because they were very well-produced demos. And so we just sort of moved that. I wasn't really thinking about the other versions when I did that.
As Matt said, we'll hear more from Michael J when we reach Rhythm of Love, but you can hear him talk about his work with Five Star. He wrote The Slightest Touch. Martika, he did her entire debut album, and more in the bonus material. And yes, he does laugh a lot more in that interview as well. Okay, so from a single, Mind Over Matter, that scraped the bottom of the UK Top 100, let's move now to a song that reached the other end of the chart completely. Matt, what is it?
Yes, next up we've got a huge hit, the follow-up to Kylie Minogue's iconic global smash, I Should Be So Lucky. That track had just topped charts all around the world, but believe it or not, there was no guarantee that Saw were going to get to produce her follow-up. However, when they did get Kylie into the studio, the collaboration delivered another winner. Let's have a listen. That was Got To Be Certain by Kylie Minogue, which came out in May of 1988. Now, Gavin, attitudes to Kylie at PWL had certainly changed when the time came to record this, hadn't they? First she was persona non grata, now she was the hottest property in the world of pop music.
It's amazing what a 5-week number one single in the UK can do for your status, isn't it?
It definitely is. Now, when the time came to record this, Kylie was on the other side of the world working really long hours on Neighbours, and by all accounts, not thrilled at all about the prospect of working with Saw again.
That's right, it hadn't gone too well the first time, but you know, a follow-up single was needed, and Saw were probably the best people placed to do that. And let's not forget, she had signed a deal not just with Mushroom, but as part of the PAL productions arrangement with PWL. So she wasn't going to get away from them that easily, even if she was on the other side of the world.
The fact that Kylie had been snubbed and left to wait around for days on end when she came over to record I Should Be So Lucky was hanging on her mind. But, you know, you can't ignore the success of I Should Be So Lucky. So maybe she might have been annoyed, but this song was doing the business everywhere and that had to count for something.
All right, at this point, let's hear a little bit from PWL MD, former PWL MD David Howells, about the situation with Kylie and that all-important follow-up to I Should Be So Lucky.
I think the impact was they realized just what Kylie's schedule as an actress was and her punishing schedule, really, doing those shows. So it was a case of she can't come here anymore. We really need to go there. So that was a practical decision. But at the same time, and Mike has some funny stories. I'm sure you've read some of them and maybe he's told you them about his having to say, sorry about that. We're more focused now. Let's do this. And obviously it changed her life in a big way.
Okay, thank you, David. We'll be hearing a little bit more from him later on. And so Mike Stock was chosen as the one to head off to Melbourne, and he took with him a few songs from the Saw library to try out with Kylie. Surely there was a second single in the batch of songs he took. Got to be certain, It's No Secret, and Turn It Into Love. Now, at the time I spoke to Mike, I didn't realise he'd taken It's No Secret, so I asked him, though, why he chose Got to be Certain and Turn It Into Love for Kylie. Here is Mike.
Well, because of the rush involved, Gotta Be Certain and Turn It Into Love had already been written. When I Should Be So Lucky was number one for the third week or whenever it would be, was that March or February, March, whatever, suddenly somebody says, well, we need a follow-up. And there's not much time. We hastily arrange a flight, take a tape. I took a tape with me of backing tracks, which I already had, which was those songs. And then, of course, working with Kylie, who was still working on Neighbours. So I only got her at 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening for a couple of hours. And, you know, and she was very tired. She'd be up at 5 o'clock in the morning to do filming. So everything was done in a rush just to get a couple of songs in the can. I got to be certain, obviously, she did it very, very well. And she breezed through both of them. And, you know, I spent my day going out playing golf. I played every blooming course, public or whatever, in Melbourne for 5 days waiting for Kylie.
So the success of I Should Be So Lucky had certainly changed attitudes at PWL. Mike actually told Classic Pop magazine of his discussion with Matt Aitken after the success of that record, and I quote, "This could be a real purple patch, a chance to really stretch our pop sensibilities rather than our club-oriented ones. We could have another side to us that would be hugely successful." Well, he was certainly right there, wasn't he, Gavin?
Yeah, it's really interesting now that not only Pete and David Howells and people like that could see what Kylie was doing for PWL and for Saw, but Mike and Matt as well could see, we've found an artist, a singer who can really take us places as songwriters and producers. And so that's interesting to hear as well, that they recognize not so much the commercial side of things, but the artistic side of things. Oh, here's someone who can take our songs to places we haven't reached before. We can go pure pop with this artist, and they sure did. But before Mike got Kylie in the studio in Melbourne, some major damage control had to be done. He had to win Kylie back over. Accompanying Mike on the trip from PWL was Karen Hewitt, who you might remember was an Australian herself, and she worked as an engineer at the studios. She told us what happened when Mike made it to Melbourne. The mood at PWL had basically done a 180, and it was now like, Kylie, she's our top priority.
Total. Yeah, I think, 180, it was a total change. I mean, because also, and I think it's been probably spoken about already, like Kylie, I don't think, wanted to work with them again. And there was the conversation with Mike Stock and, you know, the family meeting at Kylie's house to get it all back on track. And, so it was full steam ahead and we were really positive. I loved those trips back home, absolutely loved them, because they were good for me too, because I got to see family and friends. They were quick. They were always pretty quick. You know, they were days, not weeks. I think like one of them, we were only in the country for like 24 hours and went straight back home. That was especially for you, actually. So, yeah, they're flying visits.
For this first time to get a follow-up for I Should Be So Lucky, were you at that family meeting?
No, that was a very hush-hush meeting.
From your understanding, that was Mike Stock having to present the case of, okay, yep, we didn't do the right thing by you first time round, because, well, he personally, I guess, didn't know that she was even there to see him.
Yeah, you can't blame him for that. You certainly can't blame them for that. That was a Pete error.
Mike had to do the hard yards to get her back on side.
He did, yes. And he was probably the best person to send for that job. I mean, apart from him going to Australia because he was the writer of the song, made perfect sense that, you know, he would be producing the vocal. But I think he's probably the one you'd want in the most diplomatic role, if you like. He's the gun to pull out when you need to have a diplomatic conversation. Because, like, remember, Kylie was young. She was still living at home. Her family's always been involved with her career. So, like, you didn't have to just convince Kylie. You had to convince the family.
Mike was the man for that.
I guess he was. He was like the fixer, if you put it in like an Italian mafia movie. He was the fixer. I mean, and the other thing too is Kylie is so professional. Like, whatever happened in that conversation and talks between, you know, because there's a lot of parties involved. There's Mushroom Records, there's Kylie, there's PWL, and then there's the Mike Stock meeting. I knew it happened. I knew it was happening, but she didn't come in and sort of like spill her guts and like blah, blah, blah. She is just the most professional person in the world. Like, Kylie is such a professional, like, just did her stuff. You know, the songs that were done in Australia, they sound really happy. We did three songs. We did three vocals. I think the sessions did go well. They went really well.
Whatever needed to be sorted out was sorted out, and then it was, okay, let's get on with it now.
Moving on. Yeah.
Right, really interesting. So further on this, Mike Stock told Australia's ABC, and I quote, "So I've had to go to Melbourne and crawl. I went to Kylie's home and apologised for the way we treated her and told her it wasn't my fault and would she please come to the studio again and record some more tracks so we've got a follow-up." And of course, Kylie was reasonable about it, but I think quite logically, she didn't think too much of us.
Yeah, that's understandable. And I like to see Stock, Aitken and Waterman having to, you know, prove their worth in a way. I mean, obviously, everyone knew their worth as songwriters and producers, but I like them having to prove that, okay, yeah, you can trust us, you can work with us. And, you know, given what Kylie had been through in London, I think it's only fair that they had to eat a little bit of humble pie.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Now, he also said in his book that originally word had come back from Melbourne that Kylie just wasn't interested in even talking to Saw. That's apparently how negative and how decisive the word was at that point. But as he indicated in that last quote, when they got to Melbourne, Kylie herself was actually a lot more reasonable. So maybe one can assume that it was her manager, Terry Blamey, who was, like, you know, playing the bad cop in this situation. But when Kylie got in the picture, she was all for it. She knew what was right. She knew what was right for her career at that point, and she definitely made the right decision when she decided to record this song.
And record they did, but Mike was at the mercy of the Neighbours schedule, as we keep hearing, the all-important Neighbours schedule. And fair enough, there was a big cast and crew, and Kylie was only one member of that cast and had to work in with everybody else. So she would get to record with Mike and Karen of an evening for the 5 days that Mike and Karen were in Melbourne. And for the most part, those sessions went well, but Mike Stock has commented in the past that at one point Kylie did break down in tears due to being under an enormous amount of pressure. Matt, you've heard that story as well, haven't you?
Yeah, he said in an interview that Kylie was actually so upset one evening that he had to sort of abandon the session, and he was a bit upset that he didn't actually record as much as he wanted to out of the sessions. But, you know, this is an important thing to talk about because people do forget that at this point in time, Kylie was one of the most talked about, biggest celebrities in Australia and in the UK. And as we alluded to in the I Should Be So Lucky episode, in Australia, not only was she loved, she was also loathed. She was really despised by a lot of people who hated pop music, who hated dance music, a lot of people who were in control in the radio industry and so on and so forth. So not only was she being feted by her fans, she was also being hassled. She was being denigrated in the media. All of that stuff, as well as the pressure of having to follow up a global hit, would weigh heavily on anyone. And let's remember, Kylie was a teenager at that time.
Let's hear from Karen about the ups and downs of those recording sessions. Now, did the Calrec Soundfield microphone get packed to come to Melbourne?
That's such a great question. No, it got left behind. I was going to say, we flew first class, but no Calrec microphone came out. That's my, like, one and only time ever flying first class UK, Australia, is with when it was PWL.
So what was the studio like where you recorded in Melbourne compared to PWL?
We recorded at a couple studios in Melbourne, and they were, they were like the best studios around. They were, one was RBX. That's the one that was, I remember the most. That was a really nice studio. It had a great SSL console. It also had a weird connection back to Kylie and her previous life, because that studio in particular, RBX, also recorded Young Talent Time there. And I think that was Kylie's start, or at least it was Danny's start.
How did she and Mike get along? Did they have quite a good working relationship in that early session?
You know, they pretty much didn't change the relationship. They were still very much in and out, you know, do your vocal and leave. Although the tracks we did in Melbourne, we did spend more time with her. I think they were a little bit more laid back because it didn't have the, you know, the pressure and the hustle and bustle of the PWL, Stockett, Aiken and Waterman Empire, you know, back in London. And, you know, everything was a lot more relaxed too, you know, because it was Kylie's home. Yeah, it had a bit of a holiday feel to it, that trip, actually.
How was she, you know, at the end of a busy day on Neighbours coming in to record?
She was pretty pooped, to be honest. But, you know, having said that, she was also in the prime of her life and excited and full of adrenaline and all those things. So, yeah, I mean, we knew she was tired, but sort of the whole world didn't really know she was tired, if you know what I mean. Put Kylie in front of a microphone and she's always going to deliver something great, really. So she was happy as, and, you know, she was recording her first album. Like, it was such an exciting time. It was like a really exciting time.
Mike Stock has said that she was in tears during this session because of the pressure of Neighbours and Fame and all of that kind of stuff, and that when she was in the studio at some point she was in tears because the pressure was a lot. Do you have any recollection of that at all?
Oh, I can still see that in my mind's eye sort of thing. I can see the couch she was sitting on when she was crying. Yeah, I mean, it happened. It's true. Definitely. I don't know if that would be all the reasons. I know there were other reasons as well that she was that she had that particular cry that night. But, you know, it's kind of private. It's kind of poor girl. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't want someone talking about me having a big cry to the world.
I mean, understandable, because she was under a lot of pressure. She'd had two massive singles. She was on the top rating show, Get to Anyone.
Well, that's true. And like, apart from that, like, everyone has a private life as well. So, you know, there was stuff in her private life that was also affecting, you know, how she was traveling. Can you remember being like 20, 22, what it was like? I mean, there was a lot of emotions and stuff running around at that time in our lives. So, yeah, I look back at that. And, yeah, she was it's one of the few times I saw Kylie, like, be anything other than, you know, a strong woman.
And I guess it was good that you were there as a friendly shoulder.
Well, yeah, I do feel like, you know, I've had some special times with Kylie. Like, Kylie's actually, you know, there's been a few times in my life that are like really pivotal's the wrong word, but like, you know, like big feelings and stuff. So, yeah, they, you know, register in my memory bank and like just with great fondness and, I don't know, I'd go as far as to say love, you know, like she's, because you build a relationship with everyone you work with when you have to, especially when you record their vocals, you know, it's a very personal thing to do and you get to know people, even if it's just for a period. It's kind of like, you know how when you hear people talk about working on movies, like they talk about it becomes a family for a period of time. You sort of have that thing around you. Yeah, I think of Kylie and I think of, you know, like a few really lovely moments, a few tough moments, watching her career just like skyrocket, like how fabulous. Yeah, it was really good.
Okay, so with the tracks in the bag, it was back to the UK where Pete Hammond had been working away on another version of Gotta Be Certain, one recorded by Mandy Smith. Let's have a listen to that and then Pete Hammond will talk about what became of Mandy's version.
I got told off by Mike and Matt. They said I'd done a terrible job on mixing this Mandy's version. And I was told I've got to do it again. And I said, well, I don't know why. I don't know what else I can do with it. You know, I've done the best I can. Anyway, Waterman was away at the time and he came back. I think he'd been to Japan and he came back and said, look, play me this thing that you got with Mandy and let me see what they're on about. So I played it to him. He said, I won't swear, but he swore. And he said, quick, take Mandy off and put Kylie on. It's a smash. And all I did was just, they re-recorded Kylie singing it. I just did the same mix, exactly the same, and put Kylie's voice in there instead of Mandy's. And that's exactly the truth.
And so the Mandy version was put away in the vault for many, many years. It did surface quite a few years back on a Saw compilation. But Matt, we might have disagreed on the different versions of Mind Over Matter, but I'm fairly confident in predicting that we will agree who had the better version of Gotta Be Certain.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I don't know whether that Mandy vocal was just, you know, a first take that was abandoned or whether that was the proposed finished vocal for a potential Mandy release, but that vocal is awful. Now, a lot of people do slate Mandy and say she was not a great singer. I've got to disagree, at least in terms of the records that were released. I think of all of Mandy's own singles, the vocals that were on those records were more than competent for a pop record, whereas this vocal is just bad. It's out of time. It's vocally poor. I could see why they decided not to release it. And I think, look, it's an interesting curio for hardcore fans, but on its own, it just doesn't work.
I'm surprised it ever came out of the vault, to be honest. And yeah, maybe it didn't get the Suzanne Radigan magic touch added to this one. Maybe they hadn't mixed in the, you know, the additional vocals as they did with those other tracks. Who knows? But anyway, back to Kylie. So Gotta Be Certain was chosen out of the tracks that she'd recorded in Melbourne, and it was time to shoot a video, which happened back in Australia. But there were a few different attempts to get things right with the clip, weren't there, Matt?
Yeah, there are different edits of this floating around. And Amanda Pellman from Mushroom Records, who had been overseeing all things Kylie until this point, has had a bit to say about that whole fiasco. She'd overseen and sort of conceptualized Kylie's first two videos, Locomotion and I Should Be So Lucky, and was tasked with getting the third one off the ground. But she says her grip started to slip with Got To Be Certain, with PWL now apparently a lot more actively involved than they were on the I Should Be So Lucky shoot. Amanda said they'd had to do extensive reshoots on Got To Be Certain because someone at PWL hated Kylie's hair in early footage. Now, I can only assume she's referring to the controversial updo that Kylie's seen wearing in the so-called director's edit version of this video. That's the version where Kylie's painting various scenarios that come to life in an artist's studio. There were also major filming holdups as Kylie's red dress was sent over from the UK to be included in the shoot. They couldn't start filming until that turned up. Now, Amanda has said she started to feel pushed out at this point. PWL clearly knew the kind of money that was now at stake with Kylie's career, so they wanted to be involved, they wanted to be all over it. And this was the beginning of the end of Kylie being exclusively Mushroom Records based.
Yeah, on that point, let's hear from David Howells, who did take control of the image side of things and the design side of things over at PWL, about how the videos came together from his point of view.
I never went to Australia. It was so busy. I just didn't have the time to take the trip and go out and meet with the video people and all the rest of it. So a lot of the stuff was done by telex and by phone calls. So in the UK, we would commission a video maker. I would go to the session. We would art direct to a degree and all that kind of stuff, work with people. What are we trying to say? How do we represent the artist best? All that. With Australia, there were some fantastic video makers. And of course, you've got the scenery and all the rest of it. And we would work by contact. And as I say, usually it was on telephone or by telex or whatever it was, fax or...
And so did you get the videos delivered when the ones that were shot in Australia, did you get them delivered? Here's the video, or did you get it right? Well, here's a rough cut. Can you give us your notes and you ask for changes, or how did that system
work? They would send us the storyboard. We'd discuss it in broad terms and we trusted them to, because they delivered every time. Yeah.
Apparently there was some back and forth with Gotta Be Certain, though. Is that true? Because there were a couple of different versions of that floating around.
Yes, that's right. There was, and I forget the details now, to be honest, now that you brought it up, but you're right. There was a certain back and forth on that one. I honestly don't remember. I mean, we were making so many. Some things stick out in your mind. Other things just, you know, it's... I hope we did them all with care and attention, but occasionally the detail slips through.
Now, Matt and I are going to talk a bit more about the Gotta Be Certain video in the bonus material for this track, more on that at the end. We're going to do something a little bit different, but there's lots of things to be said about that video, from those jerking carousel horses to Kylie strutting her stuff along the Yarra River. It's a great video, so yeah, we're going to talk about that at length in the bonus material. But The song's out, it's got a video, and it did pretty well, didn't it, Matt?
It did extremely well. It went to number one in Australia. Well, that's good enough on its own, but it debuted at number one. It also went to number one in Finland. In the UK, it hit number two, New Zealand number two, Ireland number four, Denmark number six, also number six in Germany and Norway, number eight in Switzerland, and number nine in France. So a great result from this record, Gavin.
Yes, and it was only the second record to ever debut at number one in Australia. The first one had been Midnight Oil's EP Species Diseases, and that had been a 12-inch record. So this was the first time a single available on 7-inch had ever debuted at number one in Australia. And in terms of the UK performance, it was the start of a long relationship between Kylie and the number two position in the UK. She's had so many number two hits in the UK, as well as quite a lot of number ones, and this was unlucky to have missed out on the number one position there. But it was a massive hit. Kylie was definitely on fire, wasn't she?
She was like a genuine bona fide sensation at this point. And you got to think, all those record companies in the UK who turned her down, who wouldn't even put the record out for like a token amount of money, a couple of £100 from to buy the licensing, they must have been kicking themselves, because this girl, she could release almost anything at this point and it would have gone gangbusters. She was so loved. Now, that's not to suggest this is a bad record. This is a good record. This is a really fun song. And I've got to say, it also doesn't sound anything at all like any other PWL song of the time. It stands alone. It's a boppy, wonderful, uplifting, effervescent little pop song, and perfect for Kylie at this point in her career.
It's definitely pure pop, isn't it? Yes. It doesn't have that charging, high-energy beat behind it. It's not full-on Eurodance or Europop or anything like that. It is pure pop. Saw definitely getting into that pop sound and not the club sound, as Mike predicted. So there we go. Now, if there was one thing that could rival Kylie Minogue for popularity in the UK, it's football. Doesn't mean the English team should make a record now, does it? But that's exactly what happened in May 1988. This is All The Way. We can face any That was All The Way by, okay, this is a mouthful, England Football Team, featuring the sound, in inverted commas, of Stock, Aitken and Waterman. Very interesting that Saw were given such prominent billing on a sports record. Now, this song was released to coincide with 1988's Euros, I believe that's what they're called, but I guess the presence of Saw on the front cover was to appeal to the audience who were snapping up other Saw records. Matt, did it appeal to you?
Look, I'm going to preface this by saying that I am absolutely not the target audience for this record, but this is absolutely dreadful. It is a classic example of where a line should be drawn. You just don't ever need to do records like this, ever. Yes, there was probably a demand. Yes, it could have potentially made someone a lot of money, but that doesn't mean you should do it. I really don't think anyone involved in this record would now look back at it and honestly say it's something that they're hugely proud of. I mean, just how many Ferraris do you need that this is a gig you'd want to take? This is a horrible record and it should never have been made.
Now, listeners, I put together like a running sheet for each episode, and in that section, I put Matt : Diatribe. And I think he delivered. Now, I did add All The Way to my collection in the 90s. I got it on 7-inch single, but that was only for completion's sake. I can't listen to it. I mean, production-wise, I think it's fine. I mean, it's Saw doing what they do, and they do it well. They make the best of the voices that they've got, even if those voices are going all the way. I mean, it's really just yobbo, boorish, mates down the pub, singing along to a war cry kind of thing. It's not music to me. It's not something I want to listen to and get excited by. But as I say, I think Saw did their best with it. And speaking of being down the pub, apparently there was a bit of alcohol in the studio, wasn't there, Matt?
Yeah, that's right. So Mike Stock was quoted as saying in Mark Elliott's wonderful Ministry of Pop book, and I quote, "It was 11 o'clock in the morning and they were bringing beer into the studio. It was a nightmare. Plus the song was called All The Way and they got knocked out in the first round and so came all the way home again." So not a great marketing opportunity there, Gavin, when the team didn't really deliver.
Indeed. Now, someone else who had to make the best of a bad situation was Pete Hammond, who mixed the record. Let's hear what Pete had to to say about working on All the Way.
Were the vocals on that hideous?
It wasn't the best. You know, make it sound good. That's what they say.
So how do you make that good?
With difficulty. You can't really, can you? Just push the phase up, add a bit of effect to the voices and everything, and just make the music sound as good as it can sound to support them, really, to support the vocals. It's very difficult to tell somebody how you mix a record. I mean, even people I know, I can't tell them. Everybody has their own idea of how to mix a record if they're an engineer. I just do my way.
What kind of effect? Echo or?
Oh, echoes and delays and stuff like that to make it sound a bit more lively, I suppose. Vocals, when they're completely dry, they don't stand out in a track that's very busy. If you've got a track that's fairly empty, you can have dry vocals and they work great. But when you've got a busy track, you need vocals to lift them up.
Now, as for why on earth you'd even put out a song like this, well, the UK had form when it came to letting footballers behind the mic. In 1982, the team at that point had reached number 2 in the UK with This Time We'll Get It Right. The song might have done well, but the team, however, did not get it right. As for All the Way, well, it went all the way to where on the chart, Matt?
Yeah, it went all the way to number 64, and I've got to say that's way too high, Gavin. So I've got to say this probably forced a bit of a rethink in later years about how a football record should be made. Personally, I think New Order did a much better job with their song World in Motion. That had some good moments, probably because they limited the involvement of the footballers, although the rap in that song is pure cringe, Gavin.
I mean, I think World in Motion is the best sports-related song of all time, and I think it's because instead of doing an old-fashioned let's get the team in and try and make them sing, it's a let's make a New Order song and, okay, we'll let them rap and they can pop up in the music video, but it's essentially a New Order song. I don't even mind a bit of Three Lions, and that's probably because I like the Lightning Seeds, but that's the same thing. It's mostly a Lightning Seeds song, and Badil and Skinner also have input as well. The footballers themselves don't have that much involvement, and I think that is the way to go. But back in 1988, All the Way just did not work, and no amount of sticking the team on chat show Wogan to lip-sync the song helped it become a hit. Matt, have you seen that awkward performance on Wogan by the team?
Yeah, that is a train wreck. You could see they probably all wanted to die then and there in that video. It was funny, though, seeing how the set designers tried to make it all work with some of the guys on exercise bikes and gym equipment. So it's got some unintentional comedy there. But yes, not one of television's greatest moments.
Yeah, that's right. You can't sing? That's all right. Just pump some iron instead. No one will notice. But we as Australians can't really point fingers about terrible sports records, can we, Matt? And I might get in a little bit of trouble for this, calling them terrible, but there was a period in the late 70s when we had the likes of Up There Kazali and Come On Aussie Come On, and they were massive. And this is where I've written Matt Diatribe 2.
Well, I'll keep it short and sweet. Those were the kind of records that made me want to move to Siberia, Gavin. Not for me at all. Definitely not for me.
Okay, can we get back to the good pop now, please? Matt, what is next?
Yes, you just had a massive hit with Who's Living Who. So hopes were high when Hazel Dean returned with another Saw track as her follow-up. Let's have a listen to the song. Maybe we should call it a day. That was Maybe We Should Call It A Day by Hazel Dean, released in June of 88. It was another solid hit for her, although not reaching the lofty heights of its predecessor. Maybe made it to number 15 in the UK, 12 in Ireland, 23 in Switzerland, and 34 in Germany. Gavin, this track represented a chart outcome for Hazel that she hadn't had in quite a while.
Yes, it's the first time in her career since Searchin' and Whatever I Do Wherever I Go that Hazel had back-to-back hits, which is something to be celebrated.
That's for sure. Like, I mean, she's a very talented woman, quite a good career as a live performer, a club icon of the day, but she'd had really inconsistent chart success. So, you know, she'd have a hit 1 minute and then she'd be down in the next. This is not the scale of hit that Who's Leaving Who was, unfortunately, but, you know, a solid top 20 entry. To me, I think it's an excellent album track, but it didn't cut it as a follow-up. When you follow a total banger and total classic like Who's Leaving Who, you've really got to come with the goods. And good perhaps isn't good enough. You need another great song. This one, yeah, It's not it.
I think it's a great song. Oh, good. Another disagreement. I didn't actually know you felt that way about this song. I bought this song on 7-inch at the time. I really like it. I like the moodiness of it. I like the key change. It's another sad song about heartbreak. And, you know, as Hazel said in the Who's Leaving Who episode, she's really good at that kind of track. She brings the real emotion to a song like this. But unfortunately for me, Hazel's not really a fan of this song either. Let's hear from Hazel about her thoughts on Maybe We Should Call It a Day. And you've alluded to this before, but you feel that Turn It Into Love should have come out before Maybe.
Yep. Well, a bit like the No Fall for Love situation. Yeah, I think Turn It Into Love should definitely have been the follow-up to Who's Leaving Who. Maybe's, a lot of my fans love that song. Absolutely love it, Maybe. I'm not saying it's not a terrible song, but it's not my favourite. I think Turn It Into Love is such a much better song, and I do believe that should have been this follow-up. But, you know, there's so much going on, so many artists being recorded, and things were different then, you know, by the time we got to that stage. But, I mean, I remember being in fact, I was in America. I was actually in Capitol Records, and my Bernard Jay, who looked after me, who used to be Divine's manager, he used to look after me in the States. Yeah, I remember sitting in the office there at Capitol Records saying, oh, no, and I heard Turn It Into Love. And I said, oh, I wish this was the second single. But, you know, when you're running around all over the place, sometimes it's, you know, it's hard to sort of, maybe if I'd have been in the UK and said, look, can we, you know, maybe I could have pushed more for that to be the second single. Who knows?
With Maybe, if it's a song that you weren't so keen on, was there pressure to record it because it was Stock Aitken Waterman and they were so big at that time?
I think what it was is it was by this time it had become such a production line, and they're busy. I'm busy running around promoting all over the place. And so, yeah, I suppose in a way there was we have to get these recorded. It was a bit like that, really. But, you know, I felt the one that should have been the second single should have been Turn It Into Love.
Now, we will get to Turn It Into Love and hear more from Hazel about that song in due course. But in terms of Maybe, it's a shame that she didn't really like it. And such is her dislike for the song that it's not one that she has performed that often at all. One thing that strikes me about this song is the video. It's kind of curious. It's really dark. And it features all those scenes of this yuppie couple throughout it, you know, driving in their car and in their lounge room. And Hazel kind of dancing around in the background with that big red hat. Such an odd video.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, she was a bit of an onlooker in the video for Who's Leaving Who as well. Now, I wonder whether that was her choice not to be a participant in the, you know, the love narratives in these videos, or whether it was the directors, whatever it was quite sort of noticeable, because you could never imagine like Kylie being an onlooker to a couple of yuppies rowing, could you?
No. Hazel's kind of like this omnipresent love guru or something, singing about love gone wrong and, you know, telling them, maybe time's up, guys. Maybe it's time to call it quits. Now, another thing that's interesting about this song is that it's Hazel's latest single containing brackets in the title. I'm a little bit obsessed with this, I know. So we had Searching in brackets, I Gotta Find a Man.
And then we had Whatever I Do, bracket, Wherever I Go, bracket.
Back in My Arms, bracket, Once Again.
No Fall, bracket, For Love.
And then there was also ESP in brackets, Extra Sensual Persuasion, Not a Sore Song. So being the thorough podcasters that we are, we asked Hazel about what was with all the brackets. Is it a coincidence or a conspiracy? Here she is.
You know what? I never even crossed my mind. I never even thought about it. But yeah, looking back on it, I suppose, yeah, I don't know. I've never really thought much about that, to be honest. Song is a song. I haven't got an answer for that one.
Quite an 80s thing.
It must have been. Yeah, it probably was. I've never really thought an awful lot about it, to be honest.
So there we have it. Another sore mystery unraveled. You can't say that we don't ask the important questions, can you, Matt?
That's right. And it's worth noting that, like its predecessor, this song is a breakup song. So two breakup songs. But I think the big difference between them is that Maybe lacks some of the joy and the sort of uplifting musical vibe that Who's Leaving Who had, even though they're both very similar subject matter. And I think stylistically, it's also interesting that the guitars in this are so prominent. I wonder what the thinking was there. Was it to sort of separate Hazel from the poppier, younger stuff that they were doing at the same time with people like Kylie. What do you reckon, Gavin?
Yeah, I did notice the guitar again when I was listening to it the other day. And it is interesting because, you know, we knew the rule that there were no guitars in Saw Records unless you were Samantha Fox and demanded them. So it's, yeah, it's interesting that they're starting to creep in a little bit more. We heard them in some of the Bananarama tracks as well late in 87. I feel like, yes, there is definitely an older slant to this track. Hazel wasn't a teenager like Kylie, so she's not going to be singing frothy pop songs. She's going to be singing something more suitable for where she was in her life. People have maybe been through a relationship or two and things don't always go so smoothly. They're not always lucky in love. So yeah, I think it was deliberate.
Yeah, well, speaking of Kylie and Hazel, we should probably foreshadow the next single that Hazel was going to release in a future episode. We'll cover the great controversy of Turn It Into Love, the song recorded by both artists. Now, that's going to be such an interesting episode, isn't it, Gavin?
And obviously it was one of the tracks that was recorded in Melbourne on the trip that we talked about this episode. So pardon the pun, but we're getting closer to Turn It Into Love. Now, even though not all the songs this episode were massive hits, Saw had become a major selling point. And the British music industry, sometimes begrudgingly, were recognising that. In our next episode, we're going to see that go to extremes when a record company bid a huge amount of money for Saw's services in a charity auction. And we're going to hear from this guy.
Hi, everybody. I'm Nathan Moore from Brother Beyond, and I'm talking to Chartbeats about my journey with Stock, Aitken & Waterman.
Yeah, that's a great interview, and there's one revelation in there that I think is going to create quite a stir, so hold out for that one.
Now, as I mentioned, we're going to do something a little bit different in this episode's bonus material. Remember when DVD commentaries were a thing? Remember when DVDs were a thing? Well, Matt and I are going to try our hands at doing a commentary for the Gotta Be Certain video. So if you want to listen to us talk all over Kylie strutting alongside the Yarra, head to chartbeats.com.au/saw, where you can subscribe to listen and watch the bonus material for this episode and all episodes of this podcast and A Journey Through Aussie Pop. You'll also find the extra Michael J material there as well. Ooh, we spoil you, don't we? Now, thanks to everyone who has subscribed. It really helps this podcast keep ticking along.
Yes, thank you so much. Thanks to everybody who's given us great reviews and great star ratings on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We read them all and we really appreciate the ratings and the reviews that you give us.
So that's it from us for this episode. We'll see you in a couple of weeks for our The Harder I Try episode. Bye, everyone.
See you later.